Hello. For today's episode, I'm making a reprise of an episode from season one called The Purkinje Shift. The reason I'm doing this is because it's eclipse day in North America. The eclipse will run from the southwest to the northeast, and in preparation for this, there's been a lot of news media and stories in the news and stuff like that. And CNN ran a story on their website the other day titled, "Wear Red and Green to Experience the Purkinje Effect During the Total Solar Eclipse." And their story is advising people to wear red and green so that if they're in the path of totality, they'll be able to observe that the reds in their color vision will diminish, while the greens and more so the blues end of the spectrum, the lower wavelengths to mid wavelengths, will remain more vibrant. And the greens will diminish as well, I think, but the reds may turn to more of a neutral color, especially compared to the blues. And this is a phenomenon that Jan Purkinje described a few times, but I think kind of did it most thoroughly in his book of 1825 called New Bightridge, and where he states that the intensity of the illumination has a marked effect on the brightness of perceived colors. And in doing so, he's describing the difference between scotopic and photopic vision. And scotopic is night vision. It's rod-based and in low light, so like starlight, moonlight, stuff like that. There's generally no color in rod vision. It's just black and white. Photopic vision is bright light, like sunlight, daylight, or inside under incandescent light, stuff like that. It's cone-based, and so it's perceiving the entire visible spectrum. And then there's a mixture between the two, which I think is what he noticed and inspired his experiments and description, is that between nighttime and very bright sunlight, there's twilight, and he noticed it at sunrise. He describes in his book that evidently he would take long walks and often like in the early morning, so he'd start when it was dark, and he'd be noticing how the landscape changed as the sun rose. And so he identified what is called mesopic vision, which is a combination of rod and cone cell activity, when the rods are kind of still active and the light is strong enough to activate cones. And he's saying that the lower wavelength sensitive cones are the ones that start to be activated first. And so in that twilight, the blues and getting into the blue-greens will start to emerge as being rather chromatic, while everything else is basically colorless. And yeah, so that describes the Purkinje shift, or the Purkinje effect, that CNN is saying that people will be able to observe if they're in the path of totality, as the sunlight, as the moon passes in front of the sun, and you're in the umbra, I believe, is the direct shadow of the moon. I'm in Minnesota, and we're not in the path of totality. I believe we will be within the penumbra of the shadow of the moon, the fuzzy edge of the shadow that isn't complete darkness. But those in the umbra will experience essentially like nighttime effect, but it'll still be rather luminous outside. So this mesopic situation. And so I thought I'd play the Purkinje Shift episode from season one and think about the eclipse. And yeah, I was reading too, this mesopic vision explains how, like, in airplane cockpits and different low light situations where people need to be able to read things in the room, they use a red light so that you can maintain night vision and still have a bright luminant so that people can still read and then be able to look outside out of the windows and not have to adapt to two different light sources. So that's why in movies you'll see in submarines it's always a red light or something like that, is so that, well, I don't know, I'm out of my depth here. I know a little bit about that, but at any rate, thank you for listening and enjoy the episode Purkinje Shift from season one. Welcome to Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast. My name is Ed Charbonneau. I am an artist whose main focus is on painting, and I am also an adjunct faculty member in the Fine Arts Department at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. This podcast presents a series of conversations about color, color usage, and optics as they relate to theories of human color perception in the making of visual art and design. Today I would like to talk about something called the Purkinje effect, or also known as the Purkinje shift, and describe that visual phenomenon and talk about how it might play a role in why Mary, the mother of Jesus in Christian art, is depicted in a blue robe. The Purkinje shift is named for the Czechoslovakian anatomist and physiologist Jan Evaglazy Purkinje, who identified this visual phenomenon and described it in 1819. What the Purkinje effect explains is why chromatic intensities of colors change at different rates of luminosity, of light luminosity. In low light, the rods play a greater role in color vision, and they are less affected by longer wavelengths of light, such as the red wavelengths. Greens and blues, however, have shorter wavelengths and are able to stimulate the short wavelength and medium wavelength cones, the S and M cones, at lower light levels. So, together with the rods, as light diminishes, the blues and greens in the environment will remain more vivid. I mean, they will lower in intensity in general, just because the light is going down, but they will remain more active as the red sensitivity diminishes. So you can observe this phenomenon at dusk and dawn in the lowering dim lights, and especially here in Minnesota, we're at the end of July, and so the environment is very green right now. The garden is full speed ahead, and so the orange and red flowers that we have out there, I watch nightly. As the light goes down, sometimes the red flowers will appear to be almost black and totally devoid of light, while I can still sense a relatively glowing blueness and greenness, you know, kind of a bluish green to the foliage around the otherwise red flowers. I think that this phenomena speaks to how many of the blue cones on the retina are actually scattered out and amongst the rod cells in the perimeter areas of the globe of the interior of the eye, otherwise what we would call our peripheral vision. So if you try to imagine it, we have the cone cells of our eyes are more or less on the other side of the lens and the pupil. And in the very center of that area of highest visual acuity is an area called the fovea and the foveola. In that area, there's mostly red and green sensitive cone cells. Especially in the foveola, I think that there are only red and green cone cells. And then as you go out, there starts to become blue cells on the macula and in the fovea. But I think most of them are scattered out and amongst the rest of the globe, in and amongst the rods. And kind of a typical retina contains 120 million rods and approximately 6 million cones. The rods basically don't do much for color vision, and I think that they're kind of asleep during the day and during any kind of like bright light or anything above like moonlight kind of setting, and they become much more active in our vision once we're in those darker situations, which thinking about it, like the next time you're outside, you detect a little bit of blue, like in that black silhouette of all the shapes that are around you in the rods. And also too, in rod vision, because the rods are not directly across from our pupils, but more like around the other like 80% of the interior of the eye, it can be more effective to look at something or to be able to focus on something if you look slightly askew or aside, not directly at it, so that the light goes in through your pupil and hits those rods. So the next time you lose your keys at night, don't look at the ground, just look around, and you might catch your keys out of your peripheral vision. So Purkinje noticed this this effect that's named for him in 1819, and however it had been kind of out there, it just hadn't been shown or demonstrated scientifically. Goethe wrote about it and named it, or he didn't name it, but he spoke of this effect and wrote about it like 50 or more years earlier. And I think that that might have something to do with what Goethe refers to as edge colors. But that'll be another podcast, because there's a lot going on there with Goethe and edge colors. Now, what does this have to do with the Virgin Mary being painted blue, her mantle, as it's called, her robe? What does that have to do with her being painted blue? My art history classes, I came up learning that the reason that Mary is painted in a blue robe is because that particular blue is ultramarine blue, and it is derived from grinding the lapis lazuli mineral that is mined at the time, and I think still today, I think it chiefly comes out of Afghanistan. And so this material, lapis, was at the time the most valuable commodity on the planet, more valuable than gold and diamonds. Therefore, if you had a Mary with a lot of blue, then that kind of projected that the wealth of the patron or the community or what have you. So the bigger the Mary, the richer the person who sponsored it. And there's actually, like, to that point, there are like contracts that stipulate the exact amount that of lapis lazuli ultramarine blue was to be used in certain paintings. So the bigger the Mary, the richer the patron. I should point out a really great resource for me over the years about Renaissance painting and some of these color, what are known as the modes of Renaissance painting. I've gotten from reading Marcia Hall, specifically her book called Color and Meaning, Practice and Theory in Renaissance Painting. It's a great book. I'll do a podcast on what are known as the four canons of Renaissance painting, Sfumato, Chiaroscuro, Unione, and Cangiantissimo, which Hall describes in great detail in her book. And Hall, when writing about Sonnino Sonnini's book, A Craftsman's Handbook, actually cites the techniques that he's advising as beneficial given the low lighting, so candlelight or low lighting through stained glass windows, at maintaining the visibility of the paintings and frescoes within the church. And so without naming it, she's basically alluding to this Purkinje shift that takes place in that if you're walking into a darkened church and there's just like these candles and stuff like that before modern, you know, electric illumination, that Mary would be, and generally, you know, Mary is kind of the biggest character too in this approach to painting, because she's the most important person in the painting, so they made her the biggest. So walking into that church, as your red cone cells kind of start to take a little bit of a nap, those blue tones and greenish blues will remain stronger, more vibrant. So hence, maybe there's a bit of that going on with Mary being blue and not so much people trying to show off how rich they were by having a lot of lapis lazuli. Now, one thing to note in some of those frescoes, if you're traveling through Italy or Europe and you're seeing these Marys, they may look different types of blues, and some of them might actually seem like more like a black or something like that, or like a red sepia tone type thing. And what's happening there is, one, due to the price of the lapis lazuli's mineral, it was often applied in what is termed secco in fresco painting, which means to be applied the day after the original bouillon. I think I'm saying that right. The real fresco. So the plaster, you got the plaster, you put it on the wall, that plaster sets up a little bit, and then you start applying like pigments to it and various things so that the pigments are being mixed directly into the fresco, and that's called bouillon fresco. And then if you let that sit for a day and come back to it overnight, you can apply pigments in different ways in a term that's called a secco. And so the secco layer is not always as strongly adhered. It doesn't bind as well, so it can get knocked off or brushed off. Like, let's say they put a drapery over the thing, and it's going back and forth. I think that's what they did to the Last Supper, Da Vinci's Last Supper. There was a big drapery going over the thing. And so, and then also, too, the lapis lazuli didn't react well to the water of the plaster itself, so they avoided mixing it directly into the plaster. And so the reason then why often the there would be, like, you'd be looking at a reddish, brownish looking Mary robe or a black robe is that, like, Sonnini in his book on painting, let's see here, I can't get the reference here. So the Craftsman's Handbook, I'll have to do a whole episode on this because it's basically like reading a cookbook for painters, and it's like these short little chapters on how to do stuff. And so he's got a chapter called To Make a Drapery or a Mantle for Our Lady with Azurite or Ultramarine Blue. And he goes on to describe how to do that. And he recommends to artists, and so artists like had this book and they followed it like a recipe. And so he recommends that first bouillon layer of fresco to be painted with a color called cinnaper mixed with black, and cinnaper is a type of red. And so I think it's like two parts cinnaper and one part black. And so that would be on the fresco, and then they'd come over the next day and apply this ultramarine blue pigment, a secco, and then we'd end up with this red robe of Mary. And sometimes you can see this like blue or reddish undertone shining through the blue. They also used azurite, which is a type of greenish blue, when they wanted to save a little money, and that was also applied a secco. And they would use indigo as well, because the indigo would turn black if it was mixed with the plaster. those were even more fragile. But if you ever see like a Mary with a really black mantle, it could be that they used indigo directly into the plaster. I don't know. I'd have to check on that though. But so then this azurite color with Mary's robes, let's get a little off topic here, but one of my side projects has been trying to figure out why the colors of the flag of the United States are what they are, because I haven't been able to prove this, but I think that they might be red, white, and blue because of the colors that Mary has been painted historically, going back to the Byzantine times, when the monks in Constantinople, evidently the princess of Constantinople, wore blue robes, and that gave the monks that were doing illuminated manuscripts the idea to paint Mary's robes blue, and specifically lapis lazuli blue. And so, yeah, the flag. All right, so red, white, and blue. Yeah, so Mary, okay, so we talked about the blue robe, but she's usually shown wearing like a red or a white smock or tunic underneath that blue robe, and often a white headdress. So more often than not, and if you look at like a Raphael painting of, or something like that, Mary has got like a red, and sometimes it looks like there's like multiple garments underneath like her tunic. So a white tunic with a red one, and then this blue robe. And so I've been trying to figure out, can we trace this forward to why exactly the colors of the flag of the U.S. are this red, white, and blue? And I haven't exactly figured it out, but this is how far I've gotten. So there's this document from 1853 that I believe was commissioned by Congress to determine what became the Great Seal of the United States. And in that document, it describes a little bit about the origin of some of the colors that ended up in the Great Seal as they relate to the colors of the actual flag. And so in that document, they describe the stars as a constellation, a stars on a blue field, as based on the constellation Lyra, symbolizing unity. And early in the design ideas of the flag, John Adams arranged the 13 white stars in the shape of a lyre. I always have problems with that word. So it's like this harp-looking thing, and there's drawings of it that I found where it actually has the little lyre harp drawn right on the flag. It looks kind of crazy. But anyway, so the stars are supposed to symbolize the night sky. So then I ask myself, why is the field then not black? Why is it blue? And that's where I started thinking, well, if it has anything to do with the way Mary was painted, they'd be bringing this palette basically through the thousands of years it has existed. But that's where the trail goes a little cold here. And so because they don't go on to describe the red and the white as, they describe it in terms like the red is for bravery and the white is for something else, and it's like these very abstract, meaningless terms. They do write that the blue is specifically azure blue from the azurite stone and ground. And so that blue, you can trace that back, and I believe they reference it in the Great Seal as related to the field behind the French fleur-de-lis. So then if I go back and look at the flag of Paris, red and blue, or I don't know if it's the flag of Paris. Yeah, well, red and blue to the color, they're the historical colors of Paris. And red is identified a reference to St. Denis, and the blue to St. Martin. Now over in England and Scotland, we have red and blue as well. And the Red Cross of England represented St. George, and the Blue Cross of Scotland, which was more like an X, I believe, referenced St. Andrew. And so the two crosses put together create the Union Jack. So then I'm like, all right, well, maybe this has nothing to do with Mary, and it has more to do with these other saints and the colors that they represent. And then also, too, the language of these colors becomes very poetic and nonspecific. And then there's evidence of this guy, Francis Hopkins, may have been the actual designer of the flag, and I can't find much information about him, so there I'm kind of stuck again. Well, one kind of fascinating thing that came up in this whole thing is evidently George Washington wanted to have a six-pointed star representing each state, and Betsy Ross talked him out of it because she could evidently fold a piece of cloth and with one snip make a star with 5 points. Well, that'll wrap it up for today. So we have the Purkinje shift brought to us by Jan Purkinje, and the idea that blues and blue-greens stay chromatically intense as the light source diminishes in human color vision. So I'm thinking about Mary and the origins of why that robe is blue. We have Sonnino Sonnini and his book, The Craftsman's Handbook, that we will revisit at a later episode. It is filled with fascinating things. For instance, he recommends using cheese as glue and has a recipe for that. So cheese as glue. You could take the flavor factor of your workshop to the next level by going to the grocery store and getting a fine selection of cheeses the next time you want to glue something up. Mmm, yes. And then we have my partial investigation into the origin colors of the U.S. flag, which I think so far I've just learned that there's a lot of question marks there, but I think it's safe to say, based on the drawings that I saw from John Adams, that the guy might have been good at a few things, but he was a terrible graphic designer. And so, yes, Purkinje, the Purkinje shift. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share it with your friends and family who may be interested, and follow Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast, on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you if you have comments or suggestions. I'd like to thank Jeremy Shapinski for writing and performing the theme music. Thank you also to Grant Winkles, Susie Manili, and Jeremy Shapinski again for their production, consulting, and editing.